Welcome back. Today, we are talking about attorney conflict. Did I ever think in a million years I would have a podcast episode on the ins and outs of the rules of professional conduct? No. Was this something I loved during law school? No, it's a lot of rules and they interplay and they're very fact specific. And it's not an area of law that I practice. The rules as a district attorney were much more finite. The rules in civil practice and private practice can be different. And of course, the rules as a criminal defense attorney are different because you are representing clients. So today we are going to have to take a minute and talk about attorney conflict and the rules of professional responsibility, because it has come up now, not just in the Idaho case with Brian Koberger's defense attorney, Ann Taylor, but it also is a looming question that really, I don't think is going to get addressed in the Alec Murdaugh murder trial. So we have these two different areas of potential conflict that we need to talk about. I have stronger thoughts on one than the other, but a lot has been made out of these stories, and I've gotten asked about them a ton. So instead of trying to answer this question a million times, we're just going to do a podcast episode on it and cover it for now until more information comes out, if more information comes out. Because remember, in Idaho, there's a gag order. So the attorneys can't talk about it. The court can't address it. Unless there's a hearing, this is not going to be addressed in court. And I don't think in the Idaho case, there will be a hearing, but we will get into that as we get into today's episode. So you know what we're going to do? We're just going to get into it. Welcome to The Emily Show. I'm Emily D. Baker, the internet's go-to legal analyst and big fan of the cursey words. I've been a licensed attorney for over 17 years. I'm a former prosecutor, and I break down the legal side of pop culture and entertainment stories we can't stop talking about. We should just get into it. Let's go. Thank you to today's sponsor, Thrive Cosmetics. Thrive Cosmetics are high-performance beauty and skincare products made with clean, skin-loving ingredients. That's right, no phthalates or parabens or sulfates. I've personally been enjoying the Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara. It is a great mascara, and when you wipe it off or clean it off, it comes up with water and it like tubes off your lashes. The technology is so cool, and it is a vegan mascara. There's no wonder that it's Thrive's best-selling product. It also doesn't clump or flake down your face throughout the day, which is great for me because I touch my face all day long. I also like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It's a great cream-to-powder highlighter. You can use it right under your eyebrows or in the inner corners of your eye to look more awake when you are covering trial every single day from like 8:30 to 5. And not only is Thrive makeup clean, but it's also cosmetics for a cause. For every product purchased, they donate to help communities thrive with over 300 giving partners. Now is a great time to try Thrive Cosmetics for yourself. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order when you head to thrivecosmetics.com/lawnerd. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/lawnerd for 15% off your first order. Let me know if you try the mascara. I love it. Let's get back to the show. The first thing we are going to talk about is the Idaho murders cases with accused defendant Brian Koberger in custody being represented by public defender Ann Taylor. Ann Taylor is one of 13 public defenders in the state of Idaho that is qualified to represent clients in death penalty cases, and notably the only one in Northern Idaho. She is also the head of the public defender's office in her county. So she is like the public defender. When we're talking about Idaho, we are talking about small communities. So this coming up does not surprise me because, again, this is a small community. So what happened? It has now been reported that Ann Taylor has represented Zanna Kronodal's mother and has represented Maddie Mogan's father. Both of those representations have occurred on various drug-related charges. With regard to Zanna Kronodal's mom, there is a recent representation where Ann Taylor was assigned to represent Kara shortly before she was then assigned to represent Brian Koberger. So on January 5th, court records show that she removed herself, excused herself, yeeted herself from representation of Kara Northington, Zanna Kronodal's mother, and maintained her representation of Brian Koberger. Now, it's an odd circumstance, but not unheard of, that you would have somebody representing the defendant where the former clients are the parents of the murder victim. And it feels weird and it feels kind of icky. And we've seen media reports with Zanna's mother talking about how she feels about it, how she feels betrayed and abandoned. And I can absolutely understand that. And it's one of the things that comes in to the rules of professional conduct is how this will be perceived by clients. Does that mean it is a conflict where Ann Taylor cannot represent Brian Koberger is what we're going to talk about today. Now, Zanna's mother has given interviews to News Nation. I have not seen any other interviews that she's given where she's hurt by this. This is an attorney that has represented her in other cases, at least three other cases. With the most recent representation based on the timing of the thing, it's reasonable to believe that if Ann Taylor had spoken with Zanna's mother prior to representation in this most recent case that she was on, that it would have been a very brief conversation prior to an arraignment and not much more. The fact scenario here is really, is there going to be an overlap or a potential for overlap with regard to the unrelated case? And there is no argument that Zanna's mother's current pending case is completely unrelated to the fact that her daughter is a victim in the murder case. But it has to be weird to have somebody that you've talked to and who's represented you on three prior occasions now representing the person accused with murdering your child. I can't imagine how hurtful that would be for Zanna's mother. Does that make it legally improper, even if it feels morally uncomfortable, wrong, distasteful? And that's what we're really going to talk through today. This is where there is an overlap between legality and morality. How Zanna's mother might feel betrayed by the attorney that has represented her on prior occasions, who may or may not have information about Zanna through her mother, about her house and the roommates, or might have none of that information. Unfortunately, all we have really is speculation because of the gag order in this case. We don't know really the facts, and we won't know the facts unless there is a conflict hearing. So we're going to talk about the different types of attorney conflict that might apply in this case and how to get around those if they need to be gotten around, if you need to get to a circumstance where there are waivers, if there is that type of a conflict, then you would expect an attorney to stay with the person they represented first, not the new case. But what we saw here factually is Ann Taylor staying with representation of Brian Koberger and removing herself from representation of Zanna's mother. So as we go through the rules of professional conduct, I will talk about the fact scenario as I can hypothetically see them. We just don't know yet. I'm also making some really basic assumptions. My assumption is that attorney Ann Taylor, who has nothing but a stellar reputation from what I've seen, understands her duty to her clients better than I do. She has more facts than I do, and than anyone commenting on this case does. I also imagine that as one of few death penalty qualified defense attorneys, that plays into her mind. The fact that the current representation of Zanna's mother had just begun before she was appointed on this case, she was not deep into that representation, is a fact scenario that is going to play in here. And again, whether there is any potential overlap is fact specific, but these aren't readily intertwined cases. Zanna's mother is not a witness in the homicide case, in the factual case. Now, there is an argument that if Brian Koberger is convicted and if they are seeking the death penalty, then there is a possibility that Zanna's mother would testify in a penalty phase. And in the penalty phase of a death penalty case, you will have a cross-examination of witnesses, which is also a wild process when you're talking about the parents of murdered college students being cross-examined. But if that does become a case or does become the case, you also have the possibility that another attorney at the public defender's office could step in and take over that cross-examination in that limited circumstance, which we don't know yet because the state has not said whether they are seeking the death penalty in this quadruple homicide case. Before we jump into the text of the rules of the Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct, we're going to take a brief break to say thank you to our sponsor. There's one simple question that stresses me out probably more than any other question. What's for dinner? It takes all of my energy to meal prep, plan, grocery shop. It's probably those executive functioning tasks that I'm very bad at because of ADHD. It's one of the reasons I love our sponsor, Green Chef, so much. It takes all of the stress out of it because now when my kids ask what's for dinner, I can just give them the pictures from Green Chef and say, why don't you pick? And know that we can make dinner in about 30 minutes and be ready to go with healthy meals that fit our lifestyle. And you can pick meals that fit your lifestyle as well, whether it's keto or paleo, vegan or vegetarian or gluten-free, or just balanced meals, which is what we love. Green Chef is a CCOF certified meal kit company, and they have over 30 menu options. And if there's a week that the menu just doesn't do it for you, or you are traveling and need to skip a week, it's really easy to do on their website. We just did it while we were traveling and there were no questions. You didn't have to like apologize three times. You just got to say, skip a week. I also love that they include seasonal and farm fresh ingredients. And they've got some special options for Valentine's Day, which we just ordered, and I cannot wait. If it says it's going to be steak and probably have some truffle, I'm going to say yes. That's what I'm going to order. And Green Chef has a great deal for listeners of The Emily Show. Go to greenchef.com/EmilyBaker60 and use code EmilyBaker60 to get 60% off and free shipping. That's right, 60% off and free shipping. Find out for yourself not only why we love it, but why Green Chef is the number one meal kit for eating well. All right, let's get back to today's episode. All right, I'm going to link these down below in case anybody else wants to see them, but I will let you know that the rules of professional conduct in both Idaho and South Carolina are based on the model rules of professional conduct, down to the fact that it's the same numbers. And I think that's true in most jurisdictions that I've looked at, but of course, this doesn't come up all that often. And I think one of the biggest concerns for people here is, could this, you know, the media perceives it as a conflict. Could this conflict be something that, if Brian Koberger is convicted down the road, be something that raises an appealable issue? And appeals on this kind of conflict are very difficult to bring. And this is something that Ann Taylor, one would think, would have talked to her client about. But let's go look at the conflict of interest rules and talk through it. So we are going to the Idaho Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 1.7, Conflict of Interest, Current Clients. The reason I'm looking at current clients first is because at the time Ann Taylor was appointed to represent Brian Koberger, she was at that time assigned to Zanna Kernodle's mother's case. Whether she had undertaken any information in that representation yet, we don't know because it was early on in that case. This isn't an ongoing case. It was a case with an arrest in November, not long after the homicides happened. So that case might not have been very far along. But of course, because of the gag order, that's information we're just not going to see explained by attorney Ann Taylor. So conflicts of interest, A, except as provided in paragraph B, which we'll get to in a minute. A lawyer shall not represent a client if the representation involves a concurrent conflict of interest. And that is explained in sections 1 and 2. A concurrent conflict of interest exists if, one, the representation of one client will be directly adverse to another client. That's not the situation here. It's not the scenario that the cases are directly adverse to one another. So we're not in a situation where these two clients are adverse to each other. The cases aren't going to have overlap. This seems to be a completely unrelated narcotics charge to the fact that Brian Koberger is accused of killing her daughter in a completely separate and unrelated incident. This comes up where you have co-defendants. So the representation of one client may be directly adverse to another. This can come up in business conflicts and things like that, civil conflicts as well. 2, there is a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibility to another client, a former client, or a third person, or by the personal interests of the lawyer, including family and domestic relationships. So really, the circumstance that we're looking here, the fact scenario that we're looking at here in this particular case, is whether or not there is significant risk that representation of one or more clients will materially limit by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client. So will Ann Taylor's work with Brian Koberger be limited by her work with Zanna Kernodle's mother? And as we know, Ann Taylor chose to cease representation of Zanna Kernodle's mother, Kara Northington. Instead, she has continued on with the representation of Brian Koberger. And I think that so a conflict wouldn't arise. I also think that is to reduce the appearance of conflict. And truly, it seems that representing both, though there might not be a conflict under Section A, it just doesn't seem practical that she represents both when clearly the murder of a child is going to be something that factors in or could factor in to any sentencing or treatment or anything that goes on in the narcotics-related case. Even though the cases aren't intertwined, it is the context for what Zanna's mother is living through. And being in the same room with the person who's representing the one that is accused of murdering your child is just, is, even if it's not a legal conflict, it can't be an easy thing for anyone. And I think that's why we see Ann Taylor filing to remove herself from that case. And then you get the practical matter of what are the resources at this public defender's office? What level of attorney can handle Brian Koberger's case? And what we know in Ann Taylor's office, she is the only attorney in Northern Idaho that is qualified to represent Brian Koberger. There are 13 attorneys in the state, so 12 others. And then you could bring in someone from another public defender's office, and whether her office chose to do that or not is a different question, but that is a matter of resources, policy, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know what the other public defender's offices would say about having somebody driving, you know, across the state to represent in this jurisdiction and how that would work between offices. This is all generalizations because we don't know the facts, and I don't want to dig into what Zanna's mother has going on because she is going through the unthinkable. So digging too much into the facts of her underlying cases, they don't seem to be tremendously complex cases that would require an attorney who has, you know, the level of qualifications that Ann Taylor did. It seems to be something that is much more routine within the office, and narcotics offenses are not generally tremendously complicated. So when we're under subsection A, a lawyer shall not represent a client if there's a concurrent conflict of interest. I don't think there is under subsection A a concurrent conflict of interest. There is a potential down the road that Ann Taylor could be in a position in a penalty phase where she might have to cross-examine Zanna Kernodle's mother. However, because she could cordon off or isolate or wall around her representation of Brian Koberger, you could bring in another defense attorney who has never worked with Zanna Kernodle's mother to do that cross-examination. And the cross-examination in a penalty phase of a victim's parent is not going to be the same level of work that you will be doing in strategizing the defense of someone, et cetera, et cetera. So that would seemingly be easy to do, where you could really actually cordon off Ann Taylor from questioning any of the parents, because we now know that Maddie Mogan's father was a former client of Ann Taylor. And this goes to tell you how small of a community this is. But it's reasonable that the public defender's office, if this is so many ifs away, but if it was to go to a penalty phase. If there was a conviction, if the death penalty is sought, if it goes to a penalty phase trial, that another attorney from the office who's had no interaction with any of the victims' fathers or any of the victims' parents could be the one who's responsible for the cross-examinations of the victims' family members. That's not a difficult, not a difficult thing to do in an office with more than a few attorneys. So we're getting to section B. Notwithstanding the existence of a concurrent conflict of interest under paragraph A lawyer may represent a client if, so this is even if there is a, even if there is a concurrent conflict. And in this case, I don't think that there is. Now, this is where we get to technical legality and does it feel icky? Because does it feel icky scores very high. Technical conflict, I'm not there yet without knowing more facts. Based on the facts we have, none of these cases seem intertwined, and Ann Taylor has chosen not to continue representing Xander Kronodal's mom, which I think she has the right to do in this case. Notwithstanding the existence in paragraph A, so even if there was a conflict, you can still represent both clients if the lawyer believes that the lawyer will be able to provide competent and diligent representation to each affected client. So even if there is a conflict, you can still move forward. Two, the representation is not prohibited by law. So if there's other sections, not just of the rules of professional conduct, but other things that would prevent that, then there's that. The representation does not involve the assertion of a claim by one client against another client represented by the lawyer in the same litigation or other proceeding before a tribunal. And each affected client gives informed consent confirmed in writing. So that's a waiver. So even if there is a concurrent conflict, oftentimes that conflict can be waived. I don't think there's a concurrent conflict here, and I don't think you even need to get to a question of waiver. Even if there was a concurrent conflict, it can be worked around. Whether the lawyer represents both or not, and now we know the lawyer has chosen to not represent Xander Kronodal's mother, I think that's the appropriate or a appropriate choice. She could have, of course, also chosen not to represent Brian Koberger, and that brings a lot of other logistical and more logistical issues given the nature of the case. But you could still, in theory, represent both. Again, I don't think that's a compassionate thing to do, but legally it could happen. Then it gets asserting the rights of one client against another. They're not claims against another. Even at a sentencing phase, we don't have claims of one client against another. It's input for the court, but that gets a little muddier. And again, I think you could bring in another attorney to question Xana's mother. But again, I don't think there's a concurrent conflict, so I think that's pretty easy to wall around. And then we get to the clients give consent. I don't think you need to seek consent in this case. I think you need to have Brian Koberger aware that this has happened. I don't think you want any of your clients to be caught off guard. I think you should have notified, or I think you would have your office notify the victim's parents as well, saying just, you had been represented by this attorney, there is no conflict, and sending letters out to the parents. I think that would be in an abundance of caution and just maybe an abundance of compassion, because learning about it through the media, I think, is tremendously distressing to anyone who's been represented by an attorney. That said, with regard to Ann Taylor's representation, it was just a few cases. So Ann Taylor has to make the decision of whether any information gathered in the representation of Xana's mother or of Maddie's father gave her information about those children that would play in to this homicide representation. And I imagine that those conversations are, do you have children? Yes. And not much more than that, except for maybe an exchange of pleasantries, because none of the cases seem to have involved the kids. They're not those types of cases. They're narcotics cases, which can be fairly cut and dry. Did you have narcotics? Did you not have narcotics? Those types of things. Even under the influence cases kind of fall under that broader category. So it doesn't seem that that's implied in any of these fact scenarios. Now, I understand that not much is going on in the Idaho case until the preliminary hearing. And with the gag order, there is an interest in keeping discussion about this case going. But I just, this is more of a, I don't know, this story feels more of morbid curiosity to me and a really unfortunate circumstance for all involved than something that's actually going to create a legal issue sufficient to create an obvious appealable issue that should never, ever be broached. This feels like a very unfortunate coincidence in a very small community, truly. And I'm sure this public defender's office, because this is a small community, has to deal with this more than just in a case like this, where they've represented a cousin, a family member, or what have you, and it comes up over and over again. I am sure this public defender's office is well-versed in conflict law. All public defender's offices are. They have to be. It comes up. Has the public defender represented a co-defendant in this case? Do they need an alternate public defender? Do they need to bring in panel attorneys? This is something that happens in all of their cases. They deal with conflict checks regularly, and I've not seen any information that makes me go, ugh, I don't think this attorney should be doing this. I think it's I really do think it's unfortunate. I think that the victim's parents in this situation have to feel awful about it. All the feelings are there, but it doesn't mean the legal conflict is there. And that's always the hardest part when you're dealing with the law and the facts, and then also the humanity of a situation, because the law and the facts don't always take into account the rest of it. And that is a difficult thing when I'm sure these parents are like, but how could you do this? You've represented me. How can you represent the person who's accused of killing my child? And from the attorney's perspective, it's going to be, my job is to represent people accused of crime. And this is where I can best serve, because there aren't very many who can serve in this capacity. And that's tough. I think it's helpful to talk about what directly adverse means, because I went through it a little quickly and I'm like, oh, we should probably back up and define. So I'm going to the discussion from the rules of professional conflict. Identifying conflicts of interest, directly adverse. Loyalty to a current client prohibits undertaking representation directly adverse to that client without that client's informed consent. So the client that we're talking about would, in this case, be the current represented client, which would be Zanna Kernodle's mother, Kara Northington. So would taking Brian's case be directly adverse to Zanna Kernodle's mother? The cases aren't in conflict and are unrelated. So while it may feel morally adverse, it's not legally adverse. So consent would not be needed. But when you go through this, it continues to say, absent consent, a lawyer may not act as an advocate in one matter against a person the lawyer represents in some other matter, even when the matters are wholly unrelated. The client as to whom the representation is directly adverse is likely to feel betrayed. And that is really where the law is taking into account. If you are working against me, it feels like I am betrayed. Now, is Ann Taylor legally working against Zanna Kernodle in Zanna Kernodle's mother in her other case? No. Do I think that the client is likely to feel betrayed? Yes, I absolutely do. And she said that in interviews that she's given. It goes on to say, or I interjected in the middle of the sentence, so continuing on in that sentence, the resulting damage to the client-lawyer relationship is likely to impair the lawyer's ability to represent the client effectively. And this, I think, is why we saw Ann Taylor withdraw from representing Zanna Kernodle. Now, in a normal situation, what you would see is the representation of the parent continuing on, the client who came first in time, and not taking on this representation of Brian Koberger. I think because of the specificity and really the horrific nature of these crimes, where death penalty is a possibility, you have a resources issue that the public defender's office had to sort out for themselves in a legally appropriate way. It goes on to say, in addition, the client on whose behalf the adverse representation is undertaken reasonably may fear that the lawyer will pursue the client's case less effectively out of deference to the other client, i.e., that representation may be materially limited by the lawyer's interest in retaining the current client. Similarly, a directly adverse conflict may arise when a lawyer is required to cross-examine a client who appears as a witness in a lawsuit involving another client, as when the testimony will be damaging to the client who is represented in the lawsuit. On the other hand, simultaneous representation in unrelated matters of clients whose interests are only economically adverse, such as representation of competing economic enterprises in unrelated litigation, does not ordinarily constitute a conflict of interest and thus may not require consent of the respective clients. It goes on to say that directly adverse conflicts can also arise in transactional matters, which isn't what's happening here. It's a difficult and complicated issue, but when you look at the facts, you are really getting down to the legal technicalities of whether these two cases are in fact adverse. Will representing Zana's mom in the past, because you owe a duty to past clients, will that have rendered any information that could come up in the representation of Brian Koberger? And it's unlikely, given the scope of a public defender's work with their clients on their cases, that this will come up. Also, I do think that if there was that issue, there are still at least 12 other public defenders in the state that could represent Brian Koberger, and that the head of the public defender's office would choose to do the thing that is best for both clients, not just for Brian Koberger, but also for Zana Kronodal's mother. I think that's what they are trying to do in this situation. I don't think it is an adverse concurrent conflict, but the facts may change. And if the facts change, if something becomes apparent, does it become the situation where Ann Taylor has to withdraw representation from all clients? Yes. What is the worst impact that could have? It could delay the case proceeding forward. If Brian Koberger is aware of this, and given that Attorney Taylor has withdrawn from the other case, I don't think it's setting up a circumstance where if Brian Koberger is convicted, that he has an appeal on this issue. I think that that has been cleared. But if it comes up before the court and the court is worried about it, the judge can also order a hearing on it. And that would likely not be in the view of the public because it's dealing with items of attorney-client privilege, likely not even a hearing that the prosecution would be present at if that happens. So again, while hearing it in the media, you're like, oh, that's awful. How is this happening? Legally, is it improper? I don't think so. But I can see where it feels awful. I can see where, of course, Kara Northington, Zana's mother, feels betrayed by the person who's represented her in at least three cases previously, who she's interacted with, who she's trusted, who she's trusted to take care of her, and that person that she has trusted is now representing the person accused of killing her daughter. That is a very difficult emotional position to be in. And it can't be something that's never come up in a small jurisdiction, probably not in this exact way. Quadruple homicides are not a regular occurrence, to say the least. But this is something that office would have tackled. And with that, we have to talk about the potential conflict in the Murdaugh case after a quick word from our sponsor. I know in this episode, we are talking a lot about attorney-client conflict. And I've got to tell you, one of the things I'm most conflicted about watching the Murdaugh trial is how much I love everyone's beards. And that is absolutely no joke. We have been talking about the glorious beards on the witnesses all trial long. And if you would also like your partner to have a glorious beard, our sponsor today, Manscaped, has beard products, and they are fantastic. I have very much enjoyed getting Dr. B's beard all into shape before Valentine's Day. The Beard Hedger Pro Kit comes with the Beard Hedger. It's a cordless trimmer with a rotary wheel and 20 hair cutting lengths with one guard. That means you don't have a drawer full of parts that you're going to probably lose, that you can't click back onto the thing, and it keeps their beard nice and tidy. The Beard Hedger Pro Kit also comes with 4 dermatologist-tested post-trim hygiene products. The beard shampoo and conditioner, the beard oil, and the beard balm. They all have a natural yet yummy smell. And it also comes with 3 free gifts, including the beard brush, comb, and scissors. The beard brush makes all of the hair lay down so nice and smooth. You just want to snuggle up to that beard. So do not hesitate to get your discount at Manscaped today. Get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com using code LAWNERD. That's 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com with code LAWNERD. Spice up your Valentine's Day this year with Manscaped Beard Hedger. One stroke, one guard, 20 lengths. All right. Thank you, Manscaped, for that joy and for bringing us all of the glorious beards well-groomed. Let's get back to attorney conflict. It's not as exciting as beards. Now, when we're talking about the Alec Murdoch murder case, we have a different scenario because Dick Karpootlian, the Poot, if you will, we've learned this was actually a nickname and not just our chat looking at the fact that his name was actually spelled Harpootlian, and me trying to sound it out phonetically and being like, no, it's Poot. But Dick, you know, All week, we've been yelling about his grandstanding in court. If you want a week-by-week summary of the Alec Murdoch murder trial, I am doing that on the Quick Bits podcast and over on the Quick Bits channel. So I'm summarizing Monday through Thursday. That comes out on Friday. And then the following week, it'll be Friday through Thursday and summarizing it. Except next week, it might not be much because Friday, it was like evidence was marked. Evidence was recovered and it was marked. And that's what happened on Friday. So that roundup is taking the key points of what happened that week and summarizing them as quickly as I possibly can. So that is on the Quick Bits podcast and my Quick Bits YouTube channel. Those will be linked down below. So when we are talking about this case, the lead attorney for Alec Murdoch had previously represented Paul Murdoch in the criminal case with regard to the Mallory Beach boat case. Here's where this makes me uncomfortable. We've already heard about the boat case multiple times. Dick Karpootlian would have known from the second he heard the 911 call that the Mallory Beach boat case was going to factor heavily in to this case because Alec Murdoch believed and told 911 and then the officers on scene that night, and we're only a week into trial and we've heard it come up over and over and over again, including in the defense's opening statements, that they believe that the boat case is part of why Paul Murdoch was killed. He is accused of being the driver of the boat that night. The boat belonged to the Murdoch family. There's a whole lot more, and I break that down in other episodes about who was buying alcohol for this group. They were underage, that he was driving fast. And there's also multiple civil lawsuits that have not all resolved. Some have resolved to some members of the family, but these civil lawsuits are still going on with regard to Alec Murdoch. And there's the allegation that Alec Murdoch was at the hospital trying to silence the witnesses, the other people in the boat, with regard to the crash that night and obstructing justice. It really is a wild scenario, but Dick Karpootlian was Paul's attorney in the case where he was accused of the boating under the influence, causing injury and causing death, multiple counts. And in opening statements, you hear Dick Karpootlian talking about Paul Murdoch being irresponsible and leaving guns in the car, insinuating almost that Paul Murdoch could have been murdered with the 300 blackout ammunition in the AR style weapon that he might have left in a car and it might have been taken out of that car. It's wild to me because when I'm looking at, is that adverse interest and what is a duty owed to a former client, even if a client is deceased, that duty is still owed. So hearing Harpootlian talking about things that he might have learned from Paul during the course of his representation of Paul makes me deeply, deeply, deeply uncomfortable. But who's going to raise the conflict? Paul can't. His mother can't. His brother hasn't. And his father's not going to. It makes me much more uncomfortable legally than the conflict, the moral conflict with regard to Kara Northington and Maddie Mogan's father. Those circumstances, I feel, are a bit more morality-based, a bit more emotionally-based, where it's like, God, it's an awful circumstance, but it might not be a legal conflict. In this case, I feel not only is it an awful circumstance, but it might be closer factually to a legal conflict. And Paul can't waive that conflict. He's been murdered. Alec, well, can Alec waive that conflict? Yes, but you need both parties to waive a conflict. And using information you might have learned during representation in the boat case, when the boat case is what the defense is setting up as the motive for someone to attack the Murdoch family, makes me deeply, deeply uncomfortable. And also, Dick Harpootlian is not the only attorney in the state. This is private representation. This is hired representation versus a public defender's office who has one public defender in that area of the state with those qualifications. Yes, there are others statewide, but there is one in that area. This is a different situation. So remember how I've mentioned that our members are in the chat when I'm doing a lot of the behind the scenes recording of the podcast. Why? Because chat is bae and I love the questions I get. I just saw a question come across on the screen from Liddy Cake saying, I wonder if Alec can waive it as next of kin. Paul was an adult, so I don't even think technically that would waive it. So thank you for that question in the chat. It caught my eye going by as we talk about duties to former clients. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, South Carolina and Idaho use the same language for their conflict. So it's even the same numbers. They use the model rules of professional conflict or professional conflict. Yep. Nope. They use the model rules of professional conduct to model their rules. So the rule that we were reading before with regard to Idaho 1.7 is the same rule in South Carolina. So we're going to look at the duties to former clients because it's very clear that Paul is a former client based on the fact that when the representation of Alec Murdoch started, Paul was deceased. So let's take a look at former clients. Duties to former clients. A lawyer who has formerly represented a client in a matter shall not thereafter represent another person in the same or substantially related matter in which that person's interests are materially adverse to the interests of the former client unless the former client gives informed consent confirmed in writing. And this is hard because I have questions. The matters are not adverse, but are they substantially related when it's the defense's theory of the case, when it's the defendant's theory of the case that the boat case is related? I think they've made it substantially related, but we'll talk about what substantially related means legally in a moment. Keep that in mind. B, a lawyer shall not knowingly represent a person in the same or substantially related matter in which a firm with which the lawyer formerly was associated had previously represented the client. So this goes into multiple members of a law firm and one member of a law firm representing someone, but another member of the law firm has a conflict. This is why you have to run a conflict check and make sure there's no conflicts. And that goes again to unless the former client gives consent, the former client here being Paul Murdoch. And then C, a lawyer who has formerly represented a client in a matter or whose present or former firm has formerly represented a client in a matter shall not thereafter use information relating to the representation to the disadvantage of the former client, except as these rules would permit or require with respect to the client or when the information has become generally known. This is going to come up more in business related matters than in these matters, but I still am stuck on sub A. And then two, reveal information relating to the representation except as the rules would permit. So Harpulian can't really talk about the former representation of Paul, but didn't he talk about Paul being known to be irresponsible? It sat very wrong with me. And whether it's legally improper or not, again, it gives almost more of a kind of ick because Paul was the client and Paul is the victim in this case. In the other case, Zanna Kronodal's mother was the client and Zanna is the victim. Her mother is going through it. Her mother is a next of kin, but her mother is not the direct victim. So it is a little bit more distance than this, which is much more closely knit, given the fact that Paul is, in fact, the victim of this homicide case. The comments go on to say after termination of a client-lawyer relationship, and again, the boat case wasn't done. The criminal boat case was proceeding forward and only stopped because Paul Murdoch was killed. This boat case would have proceeded forward had that not happened. So it says, after termination of a client-lawyer relationship, a lawyer has certain continuing duties with respect to confidentiality and conflicts of interest, and thus may not represent another client except in conformity with this rule. And that's what we just talked about. So also, a lawyer who has prosecuted an accused person cannot properly represent the accused person in a subsequent civil action. That's an apparent conflict. And then they go on to give other types of conflict scenarios, but none of those scenarios even come close to what we're dealing with in the Murdoch case. It then goes on to talk about matters that are substantially related for former clients. Matters are, quote unquote, substantially related for purposes of this rule if they involve the same transaction or legal dispute, or if there otherwise is a substantial risk that confidential factual information would normally have been obtained in the prior representation would materially advance the client's position in a subsequent matter. And that's where I get stuck on this one, because could information from Paul be a substantial risk in this case? What if Paul had told his attorney that he wasn't really getting harassed over the boat case, that that the fights that he got into while this case were pending was regarding something else. And Alec is putting those things forward in police interviews as a defense in this case. And then his attorney's in the position where he might know that that alibi is factually inaccurate because he was representing Paul in the boat case. I don't know how we work around this potential issue, because it seems to me that there is a substantial risk that confidential factual information, as would normally have been obtained in the prior representation, would materially advance the client's position in a subsequent matter. It just seems that that is much more apparent here. But again, it has not come up. The prosecution has not brought it up. I still don't think if this is an issue, again, this conflict would have been readily apparent to Alec Murdoch. So if he was uncomfortable with it, he could have not hired Dick and Company to represent him. So he's not going to be able to turn around and say, well, see, because he represented Paul, I have a matter on appeal. It just sits very odd with me that this is the attorney who represented this young man prior to him being murdered. And the boat case in which he represented him is such a critical and pivotal factor in the defense's theory of why he was murdered. And Dick Harpootlian is in a very good position to know more about that case, to know more about what was going on in that case, to know what his client was going through in that case versus in the Idaho case. So this one still sits very odd with me. I don't know how they've gotten around it, or maybe they just don't think it exists. Again, I have to trust that the prosecution was, and we know they are, well aware that this is the attorney that represented Paul Murdoch in that boat case. The prosecution could have said, Your Honor, I am concerned there's a conflict here. Can we just make sure that we're all clear? Could that have happened earlier in the case and we not be privy to it? Yes. Does it still sit weird with me? Yes. Do both of these scenarios feel icky? Yes. Do I think either of these scenarios are going to cause these cases, should there be convictions, to be appealed? Not on the information I have. No. So when we look at the difference between legality and morality, on the morality side, I don't like it at all. But on the legality side, I think we're more in the clear in Idaho than we are in South Carolina. But still, South Carolina proceeds. Dick is going to dick. And that's what we've seen the entire first week of trial. He's just going to do what he's going to do. He's going to thank the judge for rulings. He's going to wander around the courtroom. And he's just going to do what he's going to do. It doesn't mean it doesn't sit well with me. It doesn't sit well. Unfortunately, Paul and his mother are not here to object. Again, I don't think his brother is going to raise that objection. And his father is not going to raise that objection because it benefits him to have the lawyer of his choosing. It just, could the prosecution have raised it earlier? Yes. Could that have been done and we don't know about it? Yes. Maybe. Let me know what you think about all of this. I'm going to take just a few questions from our members to see if I missed anything or didn't make it clear. So again, if you want to join, lawnerdsunite.com will get you there for all the behind the scenes, for the I Have Thoughts members only podcast. It's available just on Patreon, audio only, or you can join on YouTube if that's where you spend most of your time with me. There's a little join button on the channel. Over on YouTube, EIMZ. I always feel like I pronounce it wrong. I'm never sure. Asked, can you explain panel attorneys and alternatives when there is a conflict? Yes, I absolutely can. So if there is a conflict, particularly when it comes to public defenders in the public defender's office, in a lot of jurisdictions, they will have an alternate public defender's office. You'll often see this in multi-defendant prosecutions where each defendant is represented by one by a public defender, co-defendant by an alternate public defender that works for a separate office. So again, they put that wall up and things are separate between the public defender and the alternate public defender. The public defender gets cases first, they run conflict checks. If they have a conflict for any reason, then the case goes on to the alternate public defender's office. Then it depends on jurisdiction. Some jurisdictions might not be large enough to have an established alternate public defender's office, and they might just have a panel of criminal defense attorneys who can take a case if there is a conflict. In jurisdictions like Los Angeles, they have a public defender's office, an alternate public defender's office, and then panel attorneys who can be brought in if there is a conflict. And the alternate public defenders, like, you have 11 defendants. Have I had that case before? Yes. So you had one represented by the public defender's office, one represented by the alternate public defender's office, and all of the other 9 defendants represented by attorneys that are qualified by the court to serve on a panel and then are appointed and paid by the government for representation, but they are private attorneys that don't work for one office or the other so that they can take representation and clear that conflict. So there are lots of opportunities for attorneys. Where it's hard in smaller jurisdictions is when you are dealing with a death penalty or a potential death penalty case, is there are much fewer defense attorneys that are qualified for those types of cases than there are attorneys that are capable of handling less complicated and less severe cases. Misdemeanor, it's a great screen name, asked, if Kara did have to testify, couldn't someone else on the defense team just do the cross-examination? Yes, I think in the Idaho case, they absolutely could. And there are precautions and procedures that they can put into place to make sure that there's no information going from Ann Taylor to that attorney with regard to Zanna Kronodal's mom. Now, will that feel potentially awful for Zanna's mother? Yes. I anticipate this entire circumstance is going to be awful. This is an added level of awful. And I'm really, really empathetic to that. But it is also with the public defender's office, they are going to say, our job as attorneys is to represent to the best of our ability. There is no legal conflict, and this is how we are handling it. And I think they are doing that at this point on the information we have appropriately. So thank you for that question. Music to My Soul asked, could Alec be technically considered a client in Paul's case if he was paying for Paul's legal representation? No. His paying for, or the potentiality of paying for a client does, or paying for Paul's representation does not entitle him as a client. He would not be the client. Paul would be. In fact, unless Paul waived it, Alec would not be entitled to information about the case at all, even if he was paying. So even if a parent pays for a private attorney, whether the child is an adult or a minor, the child is the client and they have an absolute attorney-client privilege. The parent might be told next dates and things that are happening, but the attorney's confidentiality goes to the client, not the person who's paying. So the person who's paying does not get the inside scoop on a case unless the client waives it and says, yes, you can tell my father what's going on. Yes, you can tell my mother what's going on. These are the people you're allowed to tell. Or no, you can't tell anyone what's going on with my case. And then the attorney can't tell them. This got really uncomfortable sometimes in juvenile when you would see parents ask the defense attorneys, what's going on with this and this and that? And the defense attorney's like, the next date is this. I can't tell you anymore. You can call them and ask and they can tell you, but I cannot give you that information. So it's something that does get confusing. So I'm really glad that you asked that question. House Hippo asked, when will the state decide if they are going to seek the death penalty in the Idaho case? They have a little bit more time before they have to decide, but there will be a decision and that will be filed in court. So when they do decide, we will, as a public, we will know what they choose to do. That's a decision that an office does not take lightly. Paradigm Shift 84 asked, could the case in Idaho be thrown out due to the lawyer having represented the victim's mom? And can they retry BK if that happens? So if they tried him and the case was overturned on appeal, it wouldn't be that the entire case would be yeeted. It would be a retrial, but it would be very, very difficult if the appeals court did find a conflict, which I don't think that they would in this case, for that to be the reason to overturn the case, especially since I believe Brian Koberger would be told by his attorney that they had that representation and there isn't an ongoing concurrent representation. So no, I think the likelihood of any appeal there would be very, very low. And Chelsea asked, can Ann Taylor request to be removed from Zanna's mother case? That's already been done. So on January 5th, Ann Taylor filed her paperwork to be recused as counsel, and another attorney from the public defender's office was appointed on that case. Beach Please, which is also a great screen name, asked, how does a family attorney representing a couple become a divorce attorney for one party? Wouldn't there be a conflict? Divorce is definitely not my area of specialty, but generally, if an attorney had worked with both, it would be very difficult for them to represent one. So if they had worked like as a mediator for both, then they would generally be yeeted from dealing with both at the end. But again, the parties can waive that type of conflict. So it really, really just depends on the scenario. A lot of these conflicts, if both parties say it's fine, can be waived. It's just in both of the cases that we're talking about today, the criminal cases, it doesn't seem that anyone has waived that conflict based on Kara's statement to the press. She has not waived a conflict. She was just, her attorney was replaced. And with regard to Alec Murdoch, Paul couldn't have waived the conflict because he's deceased. So that's not the circumstance we're dealing with here. But oftentimes those types of conflicts can be waived, especially if couples go to an attorney to try to mediate and then they need to fall apart, then it falls apart and you need to hire independent representation. But oftentimes the attorney would guide the couples, I would imagine, to separate lawyers and take themselves out of the middle of it entirely. But those conflicts, and we have Law and Lumber in the chat who does deal with divorce, saying that can actually be an unwaivable conflict. And again, these things are so fact specific, it can be unwaivable depending on how much of a conversation they've had. But a lot of attorneys won't sit down with both parties. But it really, really just factually depends on what's going on. And you will even see in divorce scenarios, couples calling to inquire at multiple attorneys and having a conversation about their case to ensure a conflict so that the other party can't hire those attorneys. And you will see that as a strategy in divorce, that couples will talk to a lot of attorneys in their area to forestall their ex from using those attorneys. So you will see like the gamification of conflict in divorce scenarios as well. So it really just depends on the facts, what was said, how much information was disclosed, and what the attorneys are up to. But again, this is so fact specific that especially when we're dealing with family law, the answer for me is you are going to have to talk to the attorney. And if you're ever worried about a conflict of attorney, find an attorney that specializes in this area and ask them, have a consultation and go from there. So with all of it, let me know your thoughts on this episode. Let me know how you think. It is hard to walk through the two parts of a case. What does the law say? What does our gut say? What does our emotion say? And walk through both of those things, because we have both and both, we need to deal with both. But the feelings on one don't necessarily inform what the law is going to do. And that is sometimes a very, very difficult thing to parse. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being a law nerd. Thank you for hanging with me. It's a pleasure seeing you every day in trial. Court starts early all week long, so I will see you there. Come on into the chat. Let me know if you're a podcast listener when you're in the chat. I would love to say hello. And with that, may your Wi-Fi be strong. May your toilet paper be plentiful. May your families be well. May there be more than one box of black and white cookies at your Trader Joe's. And may the odds be ever in your favor. I will talk to you in the next one. You can find more Law Nerd goodness in our private Law Nerd community over at lawnerdsunite.com. And if you want to stay up to date with everything I'm covering, you can follow me on social media at The Emily D. Baker. I stream on YouTube on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I recap those streams for those of you a little pressed for time over on the Quick Bits podcast and Quick Bits YouTube channel. Thanks for being a Law Nerd.